My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Stuck are you here?
And I'm Gabby.
And welcome back to the podcast, my hoes. Welcome back to episode 2 of our 18-part series that we're doing on the rise and fall of Napoleon.
Yay!
No, it's not going to be that bad. Guys, it might be a little bit longer than I anticipated. I know I've never once said that before, but...
It's so funny because the researcher for this episode was like, yeah, I can do it in 2 parts. And then he messages this week and he's like, okay, so how bad would it be if it's 3 parts? And I'm like... That's on par with the course.
Is that not the problem that I run into literally every time?
Yeah, no, because he's like researching this from like a stack of textbooks, like a stack of books. And he's like, oh yeah, I've read all of these, every single one. And I'm like, okay, how are you going to make that 3 episodes, my guy?
Listen, we always try to bite off a little bit more than we can chew and we end up choking on it on the way down. And that is always what ends up happening. The Crusades was only supposed to be like a 3-part series that ended up being 9 episodes.
There's just so much. Okay, guys, but before we jump into the second part of this 3-part series, we promise it's just going to be 3 parts. We are officially going to Germany. Our trip has been confirmed. And so if we still have 12 spots available, if anyone wants to sign up.
Make sure that you sign up soon if you can, because there are payment plan options. And of course, the longer out that you go and book this, the easier it becomes when things are more spread out. We're going to be going to castles. We're going to be seeing Christmas markets. We're going to be seeing a variety of things. And the people that go, they always get first access and knowledge as to what's going to be coming next. So if you're excited for more trips in the future with us, then by all means, go and sign up. Have some fun. It's going to be a ton of it.
It's so funny because 4 out of the 8 people that have signed up for Germany right now also went with us to Japan. And I'm like, oh my gosh, the gang's back together again.
Yeah, it actually ends up becoming a long-term thing. Anyway, moving on into the story of Napoleon. Okay, so last week, we followed Napoleon through his early years in his first Italian campaign. And we had left him in Italy, having just signed a peace agreement with Austria, something that was known as the Treaty of Campo Formio. So, all right, this is the setting. This is where we're jumping into this. In September of 1797, Napoleon goes and sends one of his more capable generals back to Paris to assist his Republican allies in purging the government of royalists, because there are a series of movements that are happening here at this time. The event that would take place at this time would become known as the coup of Fructidor. Remember when we talked about that in the whole French Revolution series, how they renamed the months and all those varying things?
Yep.
Yes. So Fructidor was this. The Republican position was strengthened as a result of this, but there was something else. This required the military might of a general. And so the issue became is that leading men within the government, like Paul Barras, they were even more dependent upon Napoleon to retain their power, even if that power was now greater.
But weren't they withholding campaigns from him because he refused to do that one campaign?
In the beginning, at that time. But remember, his successes down in Italy were so massive that he was the one with basically all of the military clout at that point.
So now no one's stopping him.
So now no one is really stopping him. But here's the problem with being a successful military leader. You need to continue to be a successful military leader. You can't just stop. You can't just sit back and went, oh yeah, I did this thing 30 years ago and so now I'm great. You have to continue going if you want to maintain your relevancy when it comes to politics.
Basically, their social media.
You know, pretty much. Yeah, you will literally become irrelevant otherwise. So after wrapping up the Italian campaign and then forcing the Treaty of Campoformio on the Austrians, he returned back to Paris in December of 1797. And his population, not population, his popularity, his reputation, his everything was massive. It was stronger than ever. And as a result of this, he was given command over the Army of England, which the whole name for like what that means is that this was the force that was going to be launching a naval invasion of England itself. They were like the French were planning on marching their boots onto English soil. But just after 2 months of planning, Bonaparte would come to the conclusion that an invasion was still not likely to work. The reason being is that even with the French having tried to build up their navy, it just did not compare to the British Royal Navy. Like, there's no point in trying to ship across thousands of men on transport vessels and then those transport vessels getting blown up in the water. That's not a good idea at all. So he had to do something else. He knew that his popularity was going to fade over time if he didn't try and get a command that would have, well, good prospects, things that would allow for more glory, riches, and to bring power to the state. So with things on the mainland of Europe being more at peace, he proposed an expedition to Egypt. The whole purpose behind this and why he wanted to go to Egypt was that it was ostensibly to secure French trade interests in the region while creating a base from which they could later invade India, which was extremely important to the British economy and also power and prestige. Because think about it, the British lose India. That is a huge blow to the empire. Of course, it would be a stretch to say that the invasion of Egypt was actually strategically important for the French. The biggest issue with this was that, technically speaking, the Ottoman Empire was an ally of France at the time. And technically speaking, again, Egypt was a province of the Ottoman Empire, despite it being governed independently by the Mamluks. This is one of the weird little details in history, for it's like the state of Egypt was independent, but it wasn't actually independent. Like, it was technically part of the Ottoman Empire, but for all intents and purposes, it ran pretty much everything itself. It was almost completely independent. So the second issue, though, is that the same obstacle for invading Britain was also present in the Mediterranean, the British Navy. Admiral Nelson and his Mediterranean fleet had complete control of the seas, so this would be a little bit difficult. Even so, Napoleon needed military action, and the Directory, fearing Napoleon's popularity and the possibility of another coup, they wanted Napoleon to be as far away from Paris as possible. So rumors spread through Europe as 40,000 French soldiers and 10,000 sailors began massing in southern France. To keep the British guessing, only Napoleon and two of his generals knew where the final destination was. And that, my friends, was Egypt. So on May 19th, 1798, Napoleon would set sail from Toulon. His first stop was to secure the fort at Malta, and then under the governance of the Order of St. John, which is one of its own fascinating little details when talking about this, the old knightly orders. Yeah, the knightly orders from like back in the Crusades were still around. Like the Knights of St. John, this is the Knights Hospitaller. That's them. They became pirates off the island of Rhodes. And then after they got kicked out of there by the Ottomans, essentially, they fled to Malta. And from Malta, they essentially served as their own kind of little naval base and raiding force where they would continuously attack Ottoman shipping, like in the continuous crusades, so to speak. It's a fascinating little thing. Anyway, he took this over immediately and secured an important naval base from which he'd be able to launch further invasions. As an aside, this very small action had major effects on European politics. So Tsar Paul I of Russia had previously been granted the nominal title of Protector of the Order for previous dealings with the organization. The French dissolved the order, and many knights would flee to Russia, where they would appoint Tsar Paul as the new Grand Master. So Tsar Paul planned an expedition to retake the island, but the British ended up beating him to it. When it was clear that the British would not return the island to the Knights of St. John, Tsar Paul banned British ships from entering Russian ports under penalty of seizure and closed off Russian ports under British trade, like to British trade. This could have escalated into open conflict had Paul not been assassinated and then replaced by his more competent son, Alexander the First.
So did he do all of that because he was Grandmaster?
Yeah, basically. And it was also a huge matter of power and prestige. And think about this. What do the Russians want access to all the time throughout history at this point? The ocean. So the problem with all their ports in the up in the north is that they freeze over in the winter. And so they really needed more ports and access to other sea routes. And yeah, they had the Black Sea. But the problem with the Black Sea at that point is that the Ottomans serve as a kind of gate that they can't really get past very easily to actually influence things in the Mediterranean. So if they had a naval base in Malta, in the literal middle of the Mediterranean, that means Russian power and influence could affect things even there. Hello, my friends, Takuya here. And before we get back to the show, I would just like to thank today's sponsor, Rocket Money. For those of you who do not know, Rocket Money is a personal finance app that I have been using for years that helps to find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It helps to monitor your spending and lower your bills so that you can help grow your savings. With over 5 million users, it has helped to save a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. This is something that I personally, again, have used for years because even with all my history knowledge, I am still a person that has a tendency to forget things. And that is a major problem for me. I sign up for things thinking I need to get access for something in order to write one of my scripts or one of my articles or anything that I'm working on. And then I subsequently forget about that after not using it for 3 months. It's a common problem. Rocket Money is something that is amazing for that and does help you in many more ways with your savings, with negotiating lowering your bills, with all of this. So stop wasting your money on things that you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/ho. That is rocketmoney.com/HOE. rocketmoney.com/HOE. Hey everyone, Sakuya here, and before we get back to the show, I would just like to thank today's sponsor, eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure that your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. And that is scary for a lot of people in the West.
Closing off the ports to the British, though, was bold.
Oh, yeah. Very bold. Very bold indeed. Absolutely. But I digress. After securing Malta, the French fleet would set sail for Egypt and would manage to avoid the British Navy that was hunting them. On July 1st, Napoleon and the French would land near the city of Alexandria. And in trademark fashion, Napoleon immediately marched 4,000 infantry to the city with literally no cavalry or artillery support or anything. He tried to move as fast as possible so that the city was not going to be able to call for reinforcements from the surrounding area. And after some resistance, the garrison would abandon their positions and France would enter the city.
And that's where he fired at the pyramids.
Oh my God, no. No, Ridley Scott. No, he did not. I know that the whole reason they probably did that is for two reasons. One, dramatic effects, and two, so that they wouldn't have to actually show any of the stuff for the Egyptian campaign. It's like, oh man, how do we represent that this guy went to Egypt? Let's just shoot at the pyramids. And that's like one of the only scenes in the entire movie with him there.
And then he left because his wife cheated on him, which happens.
Yeah, yeah. Which
happens to the best of us.
Okay, that's also not how that whole thing went down, but you know, Ridley Scott, you know, you do you. You do you from all these very things.
I get all of my knowledge from Ridley Scott movies. Oh, guys, if you could see the look he just gave me. Oh, man, I'm in danger.
I say that on this note. To this day, one of my favorite historical movies is Gladiator. I love that movie. And it's not historical, really, at all, with the setup and how the whole thing goes down. It's definitely just a drama. But it's a lot easier for something like that, for representing something from over 2,000 years ago versus now.
Yes, the recent history of Napoleon.
Yes, relatively 200 years versus 2,000 is a big difference, okay? It is a big difference. And also, there's a whole thing that apparently Gladiator 2 is going to be a thing, and I'm going to have to do a review of the stuff that they're talking about with this, because considering how movies have gone, I have some worries. from the beginning.
Some mild concern.
Some mild concerns. Yes. So, okay. He goes and takes the city fast. Right. All right. With the city secure, the remaining expeditionary force completely disembarks and the fleet would go to seek shelter in Aboukir Bay. The French wanted to avoid an open battle with the Royal Navy, and they thought that the bay would be able to afford them safe anchorage, which we're going to be talking about here later. Napoleon and the majority of the army would then set out for Cairo. There were a few minor engagements along the route, which the French would easily manage, but on July 20th, the French would meet a force of Mamelukes about 9 miles away from the pyramids of Giza. Napoleon had around 25,000 soldiers compared to the Mameluke force of 21,000, and most of the Mamelukes were cavalry units who were equipped with lances and pistols, meaning they didn't really have much range on them. When the Mamelukes charged, the French would form a large square with the cannon and supplies in the center. And when the Mameluke cavalry retreated, about 6,000 of them were dead in comparison to the 300 French infantry, because the guys just charged into a straight up gun and spear wall, which I don't know if I should say this to anyone, because I'm not sure if they're aware of it. That's a bad idea. The battle was another propaganda coup for Napoleon and his forces. He'd come to Egypt as a supposed liberator, wanting to free the Egyptians from their Mameluke overlords, and he had yet to lose a battle. He also ensured that his accomplishments would make their way back to Paris. But even so, there was no real prospect for reinforcements, and every single French casualty was worth infinitely more than a Mameluke casualty. The majority of the Mameluke forces, some 40,000 soldiers, stayed away from the battle. And if we go and couple that with the retreating forces, the Mamelukes could still muster a force of around 55,000 strong, which was much bigger than Napoleon's force. And remember, with the British controlling the Mediterranean, you can't really do much about getting more troops in. The Mamelukes would abandon Cairo. And on July 22nd, officials from Cairo would travel to Giza to surrender to Napoleon. Napoleon would relocate his headquarters and base of operations to Cairo then, and the Mameluke forces were then split, with one army moving further south and another heading towards Syria. Napoleon would dispatch one of his generals to chase the southern army, while he would lead a force towards Syria. Napoleon would manage to catch up with the Mamelukes led by Ibrahim Bey, and there would win a resounding victory that pushed the enemy out of Egypt completely. But Napoleon was not going to be able to celebrate for long. Admiral Nelson and the Royal Navy would go and launch a daring attack into Aboukir Bay in what was become known as the Battle of the Nile. The French fleet felt that they were anchored close enough to shore and that they could only be attacked from one side. But half of the British ships were able to cross the French line, which in turn subjected the French ships to broadsides from both directions. Out of 15 ships in the French fleet, only 4 managed to escape. The rest were destroyed or captured. This would completely end any prospect of the French gaining any kind of upper hand in the Mediterranean. Now, publicly, Napoleon did not let the French naval defeat demoralize him. He would continue setting up his administration in Egypt, and he issued a proclamation that cast him as a liberator rather than an oppressor, a tactic that he would frequently he would employ this over the course of his career. However, the Egyptian populace didn't really believe what it was that he was saying. Like, if they even understood any of his writings that were very poorly translated into Arabic in the first place, the Muslim population would continue to resist him and assassinate French personnel wherever it is that they could.
So he was like, guys, I'm here to free you. I'm doing a great job freeing you.
Yes.
And they were like, no, fuck you.
Yes, literally that. There was also one key other thing. I remember there was a thing that he tried to do. He tried to bring a whole bunch of like Muslim scholars and very influential figures in, and was somewhat kind of implying during that time that he was kind of maybe interested in converting to Islam just to like get them to kind of support him.
But they could see through his lies.
Well, he didn't know what to make of it, because who the hell comes to their country, conquers everything, and just goes, oh, yeah, I might be interested in your stuff.
He's like, guys, I'm one of you. Don't hate me. Come on. All's fair in love and war.
Oh, yeah. So in early 1799, Napoleon moves an army of 13,000 men into the Ottoman province of Damascus. He goes and assaults several coastal fortresses, including a brutal siege of Jaffa. And Jaffa held significant strategic importance for supply lines, and Napoleon knew that he would need to secure the fortress if he wanted to continue his advantage. So early in the siege, Napoleon would send an envoy to the garrison commander to discuss terms of surrender. But the envoy was returned to the French without a head. This was going to very much piss off Napoleon, and the assault on Jaffa would be bloody. But the French would succeed in breaching and securing the fortress. In the coming days, Napoleon had 4,500 prisoners shot or beheaded in bloody reprisals in order to send a message to future towns that they needed to surrender. Also in kind of revenge for what it is that they did to his envoy. After securing Jaffa, Napoleon would lay siege to Acre. And by this point, the British Royal Navy was actively reinforcing the coastal fortresses wherever possible. At Acre, the French were able to take outer defenses, but the British would land boat crews and artillery pieces to assist in Acre's defense. As it happened, a French emigre and engineer who attended the École Militaire with Napoleon was actually the guy who was in charge of placing the artillery and used Napoleon's tactics against him. The defenders would fight off three French assaults and from that would force Napoleon to withdraw or suffer even more heavy losses. French forces, by that point, remember, since they can't really reinforce, are becoming dangerously depleted. Despite less than 2,000 soldiers dying in combat, thousands of more were being lost to disease, dehydration, and desertion. During Napoleon's retreat from Acre, it's alleged that Napoleon ordered that soldiers who were too ill to march were to be poisoned with opium to speed the army's movement. And upon returning to Egypt, Napoleon would march to Abukir, whose fort was now defended by a garrison of 18,000 men. On July 25th, the French would attack and would rout the defenders after a few hours. Close to 10,000 Ottomans would drown trying to escape, with hundreds more being bayoneted before they could actually make it to the water. Only a few hundred of the original force of 18,000 managed to escape. The land battle at Abukir, this was going to be Bonaparte's last action in Egypt. There simply wasn't anything else they could really do there, and Napoleon had learned of events that were taking place back home in Paris. The French armies were suffering against its enemies, and the current administration was losing authority. Napoleon would go and justify to himself that his country needed him to restore order and began to plot his return. Practically speaking, Napoleon's position in Egypt was hopeless. There was nothing that they could do. The population did not view him as a liberator. They were openly resisting his administration. The army was running low on supplies and manpower, and getting further support from Paris, that just wasn't possible. Napoleon could not achieve anything by staying. So Napoleon and a few of his closest friends and generals would board a ship in mid-August of 1799, under the pretext that they were going to be cruising around the Nile Delta so as to not arouse suspicion. The escape was so shrouded in secrecy that Napoleon did not even tell his successor in Egypt, except by letter, which was delivered after he departed.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww. Yeah.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
So he didn't leave to go back because Josephine was cheating on him.
No.
But he could have.
No.
But maybe, theoretically, at the same time, he could have also, it could have been a dual purpose.
No, leaving. Ridley Scott. No. Okay. It was grand scale political events that were happening, not his freaking cheating wife.
I like the cheating wife one more because that's a little bit more romantic, a little bit more dramatic. I mean, war is all fine and good, but.
So, yeah, he leaves, right? And the army did not initially take the news well, of course, but the new commander would assure everyone that Napoleon would return with reinforcements and supplies to continue the mission. And so the French army would continue to operate in Egypt all the way through September of 1801, when they were finally able to surrender to the English and were then repatriated back to France as part of the deal. The French also had to hand over many of their scientific discoveries to the British, including the Rosetta Stone, which many people think it was a British discovery. Nope, it was a French one, which the British had to then negotiate through blood to get. Napoleon's voyage home was largely uneventful. They would briefly stop by in Corsica due to the weather in early October of 1799, and he didn't know it in the moment, but this was going to be the last time that Napoleon would ever set foot on his homeland. On October 8th, Napoleon would land in France and immediately set out for Paris. France was at this time threatened with invasion, and unbeknownst to Napoleon, the Directory had sent orders for him to return to France with his army. However, due to the British blockade, those messages never actually reached Napoleon. By the time that he returned, French armies had managed to secure several victories that would stave off invasion for now. But despite his failures in Egypt, Napoleon was still greeted as a hero by the population. The Directory, though, were quite suspicious of him. They wanted to punish him for his failure to secure Egypt and for deserting his army, but the Republic was bankrupt and the Directory was simply too weak to actually punish him. They needed him more than anything. Napoleon quickly would go about setting himself up to secure allies amongst the French legislators and at the same time some of the members of the Directory. Then on November 9th, 1799, Napoleon, backed by his brother Lucien and a detachment of grenadiers, would force the government to dissolve and appoint Napoleon and two of his allies as consuls. Yes, as in like the consuls is in like the whole Roman consulate system, like the people in charge of the military and the government. Now, in theory, Napoleon held equal status with the other two consuls. But in reality, yeah, he was the guy who was quickly in charge. He very quickly would consolidate power and would institute new rules for the legislative bodies that and how they were supposed to be elected. These new rules would ensure that Napoleon, his interests, and his allies were always going to be the guys who had the real power in France. He would even introduce a new constitution that was ratified by the general population by a miraculous margin. We are talking about 3 million votes in favor with just 1,562 against. That's it. The numbers in the situation are they might be a little bit fudged. Napoleon also understood by this point that France was holding on by a thread. He wanted to make peace with the other European powers, but he felt that he couldn't secure advantageous terms without more military victories.
How do you make peace? By having more war.
It's not the peace. He can get peace pretty much at any time. Probably. Maybe. It's debatable. But the terms of the peace, being granted certain land, being granted certain trade deals, being granted reparations, that's the term. All of these things will be determined based off the war. So the more victories that he wins, even if he doesn't have to physically occupy the other land, they may just give him stuff.
Okay, so he just wanted to show them, hey, I'm super scary. You want to do what I want, like what I say.
Literally, yes.
Makes sense.
Literally, yes. Just he needs to get as good of a deal as he possibly can, because the better the deal that he also has, the more it secures his own popularity and legacy within France. That's the whole point. So what he then does is he assembles an army of 24,000 men and he crosses the Swiss Alps to invade Italy, which by this point had already been reclaimed by Austrian forces. On June 14th, 1800, Napoleon would go and clash with Austrian forces at the Battle of Marengo. The Austrian army was little more than 30,000, and they had initiated the battle. In a very rare turn of events, it was Napoleon who was caught off guard and was slowly losing the battle. But early in the afternoon, French reinforcements would arrive and would push the Austrians off of the battlefield, leaving behind 14,000 casualties. The next day, the Austrians would agree to abandon northern Italy and would sign an armistice, that's the term, an armistice with, well, you know, permanent peace deals were still being discussed.
Okay, so reinforcements. So when they go to battle and they have like 24,000 men, do they just have like 10,000 more men marching behind?
Kind of. Actually, yes. In some cases, they would. So you typically have multiple forces that would be split up. You wouldn't just have your forces move in one giant block or column, right? And then on top of that, even when you go into a battle, there's a term of reserves. So let's say you have a force of 10,000 men. You only sent forward about 6,000 of those men, and then you kept 4,000 in reserve. The reserve are typically then used to take advantage of a situation like, oh, you need to launch an attack on this specific position that is a weaker point for the enemy, or maybe your own men in the center are starting to fall apart and you need to reinforce their positions by sending in the reserve.
Okay, I get that. But if you split your forces back then, it's not like you have GPS. You don't have a cell phone. You're not going to be like, okay, meet me at the rock next to the tree where we're going to fight on this big battlefield next to the river.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And that's also why they would utilize teams of messengers to kind of keep track as to where the armies were for their varying different positions. And they would send off these messengers to meet up, to ride, and then this courier system would be able to communicate that.
Were there battles where the reinforcements got lost?
Yes. Oh my God, yes. All throughout history, there have been cases of reinforcements getting lost, not showing up on time, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes refusing to show up.
Okay, I could see that happening. Just be like, okay, you guys are losing. Why would we?
The worst cases of reinforcements just not doing that were you'd have generals that would be controlling armies, and those generals were rivals with the other generals, and they would go, oh no, oh, I'm sorry, I just couldn't make it in time. Bad luck.
What?
Yeah, that was a big problem. In fact, one of the big issues even that the British had during the American Revolution were British generals competing with one another for essentially power and influence. So they were oftentimes working almost against each other down in the South as they were working together.
I love that, though. That can't happen today because we know where everyone is, right?
Kind of, yes. It still can happen, mind you, but not like what it would have before. What would happen now is you can have situations where maybe it's on the much more minor level of, oh, someone didn't call in something that they were supposed to for logistics. Oh, no, I forgot to file this paperwork that was going to get your men some time off. You know, like just some, there's way more minor things they can do now.
Like they could be petty, but they can't be detrimental to the overall war effort.
It would be much harder to. Yeah, that's right. That's definitely right. So after these victories, right, Napoleon was immensely popular. He was already popular, but his popularity now was stronger than it ever was. But his enemies were also growing. Napoleon would survive several assassination attempts, and ultimately, he would use these as a pretext for arresting hundreds of Jacobins and Royalists, further strengthening his own grip on the government. In March of 1802, the British and the French would formally sign a peace agreement. It was widely believed that this was something that was, while good, only going to be a temporary peace, with both sides licking their wounds and preparing for another conflict. During this peace, Napoleon was elected consul for life by the general population, with 99% of the votes being in favor. At least that was the official party statement, mind you.
What was the point of getting rid of a king and then just putting someone in charge for life?
The king was, to be fair, kind of horribly incompetent. Napoleon was not.
Well, I get that, but still, everything they worked to break down for, like, having somebody just, like, with all of this power, they just gave somebody all of this power.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true.
It's almost like the French enjoy having something to revolt against.
No, it's true. No, you are entirely right. The whole purpose of the French Revolution kind of came crashing down. And there's a reason why there have been multiple French revolutions, so to speak. There's been, of course, there was the one big one, and we covered that in its entirety, which is this whole thing that is even now, this is an offshoot of it. But the French have had multiple different revolutions, so to speak, and there is a reason why they are currently on their, was it the Fourth Republic or Fifth Republic?
They're on one.
Okay, hold on. No, this is going to bother me. The Second French Republic was brought down by Napoleon III. Well, the first one was brought down by Napoleon. The second one was brought down by his nephew, Napoleon III. This brought then the third French Revolution, or not the revolution, but the third government of the Republican government. The third government is what was brought down. Okay, they're on their fourth.
Are they on their fourth? Because I just Googled it and it said the Fourth Republic was dissolved on the 5th of October, 1958.
Oh, wait, it was the third that was brought down. First one was brought down by Napoleon. The second one, you had the Bourbon Restoration. This was then brought down and a new Republican government was put into place. This was then brought down by Napoleon the third, right? And then you had the third one. When did the third one end?
1940.
Oh my God. That's why, of all things, why would I suddenly forget that the third Republican government would be destroyed with the occupation of Germany?
And then the Fourth Republic is 1946 to 1958. And the fifth one is 1958 to present day. Also, how does it work nowadays? Like, I know this one guy has been prime minister or president forever.
The French system allows for, I think it was 7 years. When you're the president of France, it's a 7 year term, if I recall correctly.
And how many terms can they do that?
I don't remember.
Because I feel like this guy's been around since I gained consciousness enough to pay attention to politics.
I mean, I remember he...
Good old Macaroon.
I think it was... Was he elected in 2014? And I think it might be two terms. So I think that's a total of 14 years.
I was still in high school.
Because I'm pretty sure he won re-election in like 2021 or 2022.
So he's going to be there for a while unless they like revolution him.
This is going to bother me. I know that a bunch of people are like, oh, get back to the story of Napoleon. Okay, hold on.
We're almost done with this story of Napoleon. We also need some side quests, guys. That's the whole point.
Macron election, was it 20? Oh, it was 2017 when he was elected? Okay, so hold on. He was elected in 2017. That went for, it's a 7 year period. And that means that, okay, he just won re-election. That was the thing. Macron just won re-election, right? It's a side quest. I know, okay, but it's something in here. In 2022.
It's so funny though, because there's this one article that goes, the headline is Macron slams two-term limit on French presidency as damnable bullshit. Oh no. Napoleon the 17th.
Which ironically, to this day, there actually are still houses within France. You have the Orleanist house, you have the Bonaparte, and you have the other one. Why can I not remember the other one?
Why can't you remember anything today?
Orléans, Bourbon, and Bonaparte. Those are the three.
Sorry guys, his brain, we had it charging and I guess he didn't let it like complete.
Anyway, yeah, there's still a whole thing that you could claim, like, who actually is the rightful heir to the throne of France today. Like, that is a thing. So anyway, yeah, he gets elected with 99% of the vote. And he also then uses the temporary peace to go and shore up the French colonies, to fix up the French economy, and to strengthen the military. By 1803, conflict with England seemed imminent. And Napoleon decided that he needed to raise cash before hostilities would break out. His solution at this time was the Louisiana Purchase. This agreement would allow the United States to double its land size in return for $15 million of badly needed funds, which was an amazing deal for the Americans. And it completely, like, it's kind of funny. He really needed this money, right? So the Louisiana Purchase is a thing that probably helped to propagate even more wars in Europe. That's another funny way of looking at it. Another attempt by French royalists to remove Napoleon through assassination was carried out in February of 1804. This attempt also failed, naturally, but it allowed Napoleon to once again use the plots as a pretext to further his ambitions. He secured the necessary support on May 18th, 1804, and in that, the Senate would proclaim Napoleon Bonaparte Emperor of the French.
They went from a king to an emperor.
Yes.
Why? Do they understand that an emperor is more powerful than their king, their former king?
But now it was the glorious French Empire that was winning great victories all over the world. And that was the important detail. With this, they would approve a new constitution. And do you want to guess how big of a vote this was?
Landslide victory.
99% of the popular vote, like one from the general population. This is what would confirm Napoleon's new government.
Yay. Also, quick little side note, but you said the presidency for the French was 7 years. But in 2000, a referendum shortened that term from 7 years to 5 years.
Ah, that's what it was. Okay, because I was wondering, the math didn't add up on like the whole 2017 to 2022. So that's what it was. Awesome. Thank you for that, Gabby. So yeah, the vote happens here. It confirms his power. However, his ascension is not recognized by the European community, with the lone exception being Austria, who was not ready for another conflict and was like, oh yeah, awesome. We now have not a crazy revolutionary nutjob case. We have an actual empire again. Awesome. You know, monarchists in Europe were somewhat pleased with that at least. And so it was then that a minor Italian nobleman born on the island of Corsica became the French emperor. On December 2nd, 1804, Napoleon was crowned Emperor of the French. Pope Pius VII would anoint Napoleon before. Napoleon would ultimately and famously crown himself with a replica of the crown of Charlemagne. That's right, that there's this whole thing of Napoleon snatching the crown off the out of the Pope's hand and crowning himself.
Is that even legal?
Let me explain this. Okay, it makes sense. It makes sense as to why he would do this. A lot of people try to say that this was Napoleon's ego. That is the reason as to why he did it. No. There is a huge symbolical thing there. Do you remember when we did the whole thing on the Holy Roman Empire, Gabby, with the Ghibellines and the Giuseppes, and the whole point about the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire had to be crowned by the Pope?
Yeah.
This meant that the Pope had a lot of authority over the Holy Roman Emperor. So the original HRE emperor, Charlemagne, where a lot of them would derive their authority from later on, though it's really the Carolingian Empire is a different entity than the Holy Roman Empire, to be fair. But still, either way, in crowning himself, that meant that the empire, he, was not going to be beholden to the Pope. The Pope wouldn't have this authority over the French state. That was only him. So it wasn't a thing that was done out of ego. It was literally a separation of church and state, of he is separate, he is his own authority and entity, and the Pope can't tell him what to do.
The whole thing was just to say the Pope can't tell him what to do.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah, that's the whole thing here. So that's what happens. And that really is it for us here today. We're going to wrap up Napoleon's story in next week's episode. I promise that is going to be a thing. We're at the point where, you know, he gets crowned. He is the emperor. The only thing left for him to do now at this point is lose that crown.
That's really sad that getting crowned emperor and then losing the crown. Kind of disappointing.
Especially since he rose up from literally nothing.
You hate to see it.
Yeah. My friends, thank you all for listening. I hope you'll join us for the next one. And I hope that you check out our links in the descriptions down below here for Patreon. If you want ad-free episodes, if you want to join us on one of our trips to travel here in the future, any of it. By all means, thank you for listening. And I'll see you next time. Goodbye, my friends.
Bye.